the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation, here's Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Good morning and happy Thursday. Yesterday, U.S. Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue announced the re-enrollment deadline for the Dairy Margin Protection Program has been extended yet again. The new deadline for dairy farmers is now June 22nd. So far, USDA offices have given $89 million for margins triggered in February, March, and April, and they will continue to process remaining payments daily. Research has showed that the discovery rate of the Asian citrus psyllid is improving. Brian German met with growers and researchers at the last industry meeting in Tulare County, and we'll find out what they had to say later in today's show. And also yesterday, Taylor Hillman talked with California Farm Bureau Federation about the Senate's version of the Farm Bill markups. Now, we know that they consider the House's version a win for state producers, and I have been told by Taylor that they have mutual feelings for the Senate's version as well. Taylor Hillman has that story now.
The Senate's version of the Farm Bill is officially out for debate as the Ag Committee passed the bill 20-1, and the California Farm Bureau says that's A-OK for California producers. CFBF Director of Federal Policy Josh Rolfe said the Senate markup of the Farm Bill should be viewed as beneficial to the state's producers for much of the same reasons that the House version was.
Senate Farm Bill, we've had a few days to chew on it and to digest and analyze, and we're really coming away similar to the same impression that was left with the House bill, which is this is overall a very positive bill for agriculture. It has a lot of provisions that we were worried would be either on the chopping block or cut altogether. And I think if you're a California producer of just about any commodity, you're gonna like what's in the Senate bill.
Rolfe said again that the fear is that specialty crops resources can be the first to be cut. Having a ranking member in the Senate Ag Committee with Michigan's Debbie Stabenow may have helped that.
Yeah, it's a newer program. I mean, in the scheme of things, of the 80-plus year history of Farm Bill, specialty crops was just introduced in the last decade. And so it being so new, there's always the threat that new programs will go away. And instead, I think in large part because of the position Debbie Stabenow, Senator from Michigan, has as the ranking Democrat on the committee, she's been a strong proponent of specialty crops and one of the principal authors of that title being added in the 2008 bill. And so her being there, I think, ensured that a lot of the specialty crop programs have been protected.
Stay with AgNet West for more Farm Bill takeaways from the California Farm Bureau. I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West Radio Network.
Talk of tariffs and other trade disruptions is not daunting members of the U.S. Trade Mission in Japan this week. Gary Crawford has the story.
The Agriculture Department's Undersecretary for Trade says he doesn't know what the next steps will be for economic and trade discussions with Japan.
I do know that the U.S., and I think, frankly, Japan as well, want very much to get into some trade discussions.
Ted McKinney is in Japan this week leading a U.S. trade mission, a group representing U.S. food and ag businesses and others, and he told reporters it seems the U.S. prefers one-on-one negotiations. Japan would prefer the U.S. rejoin the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Meanwhile, there is talk of tariffs and other possible trade disruptions, but as to that affecting the trade mission folks?
The group is remarkably upbeat. They are realistic. They know that there are tariffs. There might be more coming, but they recognize the importance of this market, and it was one of, you know, we'll roll with whatever we've got.
McKinney said trade mission participants are telling him it's worth going on the mission to build new sales and trade opportunities for the future.
That was Gary Crawford reporting for USDA in Washington. Stay tuned for the snip of the press conference with Secretary McKinney later in today's interview segment. But for now, here's Brian German.
Several dozen industry members were on hand for the spring citrus meeting that was held last week at the Tulare County Agricultural Building. The day began with an ACP-HLB update from UC Cooperative Extension Citrus Advisor for Tulare, Fresno, and Madera counties, Greg Duhan. He noted that quarantine efforts and increased public awareness seem to have helped reduce the number of psyllids being discovered.
Yeah, it seems to be not as bad. Basically, in Southern California, the insect is pretty much endemic to that whole region. But as far as the valley goes, a year or 2 years ago, there was quite a bit of fines in Bakersfield, and it's curtailed a lot. So we find it, or CDFA finds it on these traps. But they find, you know, one insect here, another one there. They're not finding that many live populations of the insect. So it is sporadic, and it seems to be moving along corridors, so it's probably being moved with people.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now.
Senate Bill 88 requires that all water right holders who have previously diverted or intended to divert more than 10 acre feet per year to measure and report the water that they divert. UC Cooperative Extension will be holding multiple SB 88 compliance workshops around the state to help clarify reporting requirements for ranches. The workshops will present information on how to determine measurement equipment accuracy and how to calculate and report volume from flow data. The first two workshops are going to be held on Friday, June 29th. The first one starts at 8 a.m. at the Humboldt County Agriculture Center in Eureka. The second workshop will begin at 3:30 in the afternoon at the Trinity County Fairgrounds Dining Hall in Hayfork. Registration is open about 4 to 5 weeks before each class begins, and those interested can register by visiting their local Cooperative Extension website or finding the relevant course on the Cooperative Extension event calendar. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Almond growers have a new tool this year to add to their checklist of things to do at hole split. AF-36 can be applied during this time to fight against aflatoxins. ABC's Bob Curtis explains.
We now have a new tool in the almond industry. It's a biological control to reduce the amount of, ultimately the amount of aflatoxin that is produced coming from the orchard. The way this mechanism works, it's, well, first of all, the product is called AF-36. It's Prevail. It's commercially available. And the way it works is that you actually seed a material into the orchards about 2 weeks prior to hull split. And these are wheat seeds that actually contain fungus. The fungus that creates aflatoxin, and it's an aspergillus fungus, there's different strains. There's the strains that cause the aflatoxin, and then there are also the strains that are called atoxigenic or do not create aflatoxin. The material that is seeded into the orchard contains the aspergillus that does not produce toxin, and the whole idea is that it will get a head start and displace the niches, if you will, of the toxin-forming aspergillus so that you really reduce the amount or the potential for aflatoxin generation within the orchard.
I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West Radio Network.
Well, in today's livestock news, of course, it was announced yesterday that U.S. Senate Ag Committee did pass out of their committee the 2018 Agricultural Improvement Act, or otherwise known as the Farm Bill. In the release, Chairman Roberts and Ranking Member Stabenow said the Senate Ag Committee's bipartisan Farm Bill process is a reminder of how things should work in Washington, listening to the folks back home, working through issues with the other side of the aisle, then writing a good bill. This legislation will now head on to the full U.S. Senate for consideration. Well, a variety of commodity groups came out with releases showing their pleasure to the Senate Ag Committee passing their version of the Farm Bill. One of those was the National Milk Producers Federation. They commended the leadership of the Senate Ag Committee for crafting a bipartisan Farm Bill that contained beneficial provisions for America's dairy farmers. Following passage of that, NMPF put out a release noting that the Senate Farm Bill contains enhancements to the Dairy, Margin Protection Program, or MPP Dairy, that was sought by NMPF. It does include improved coverage levels and greater program flexibility. Now, the measure raises the maximum covered margin to $9 per cut weight and adjusts the minimum percentage of milk that can be insured. It also includes an important agreement reached between NMPF and the International Dairy Foods Association on price risk management. In a release, NMPF President and CEO Jim Mulhern said the leadership of Senators Roberts and Stabenow led to the creation of this bipartisan farm bill that has the important provisions that dairy farmers had needed. He said with the House also set to move on its own version of the farm bill later this month, they're hoping a final measure will pass Congress by this fall. Now, the Senate bill also contains conservation provisions that will help producers access technical and financial assistance in order to carry out conservation practices on their operations. Under the trade title, the Farm Bill also reauthorizes the trade promotion program that's critical to dairy farmers and their cooperatives. Mulhern said NMPF also appreciates the successful efforts of Senators Jody Ernst and Bob Casey to include provisions in the bill that promote the consumption of fluid milk. But again, the Senate Ag Committee did pass their version of the Farm Bill yesterday and now moves on to the full Senate for consideration. It was also announced by U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue this week that for the second time, they've extended the re-enrollment deadline for the Margin Protection Program, or MPP Dairy. The new deadline is now June 22nd. Of course, the new and improved program does protect participating dairy producers when the margin or the difference between the price of milk and feed costs falls below levels of protection selected by the applicant. USDA has already issued more than $89 million for margins that were triggered this past February, March, and April, and their offices are continuing to process remaining payments. In a release, Perdue said, "We've reopened enrollment to offer producers preoccupied with field work an additional opportunity to come into their local office to sign up." He said more than 21,000 American dairies have already gone into their FSA office to sign up. To learn more, contact your local FSA office. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West. AgReview with Everett Greiner is next.
Well, they're gone now. A problem is still there, however. I'm talking about those wildfires that swept through Oklahoma earlier this year. Just like those that swept through Montana and California last year, the damage will take years to erase. And officially, 350,000 acres burned in Oklahoma. It'll take $26 million at first count. Could go higher. You see, the grass that burned is just one of the costly parts of restoration. There were losses of livestock. Don't know how many yet, but it's going to be heavy. Growers lost years worth of hay. That means heavy damage to pasture land. A lot of fencing will have to be replaced. That's not cheap either. And a few landowners even lost barns and utility buildings. These are not all, but you can see what wildfires can do. And that's AgReview for today. Everett Greiner, Southeast AgNet.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now.
California has a reputation for attracting some rather interesting characters. This year, there's been another one on the loose, making a name for himself out on the Mojave Desert. He built a steam-powered rocket and shot himself up into the sky about 1,800 feet, hitting 350 miles an hour, then falling back to Earth, all to somehow prove that the Earth is flat. Mad Mike Hughes is a 61-year-old limo driver, amateur rocket scientist, and claims to be a devout flat earther. A few years ago, he decided to create a GoFundMe page to build a rocket, but it went nowhere. He raised about $300, then one day had a revelation and decided that the Earth was flat. Not only was it flat, somehow he could prove it if he could just fly around in his rocket and take a look around. He went on an internet radio show dedicated to flat earthers and professed he was a recent convert to the flat earth ideology. He explained his project to the host and his 300 and so listeners, who were impressed that he'd actually been in a rocket. He said he was the real McCoy, unlike those fake actors that were paid by NASA to act like they were up on the moon or on the space station. Well, Mad Mike must be quite a talker, because the show host and his listeners decided to back his project. The limo-driving rocket man got an infusion of cash. A Flat Earth Society GoFundMe drive raised about $8,000 for Hughes. It goes to show P.T. Barnum was right, and there's still one born every minute. Mad Mike got to build his rocket, and he launched it last week, flying over the town of Amboy. It had to be quite a sight, a bright red home-built rocket launching into the sky with Mad Mike riding along. It went up about 2,000 feet, then it came back down, straight down. And fortunately for Mad Mike, his parachutes deployed. It brought him back to Earth at a fairly reasonable speed. He was bounced around pretty bad and was taken to the hospital in an ambulance, but he had survived his landing with some minor injuries. He didn't get to look around much during his flight. He didn't even get as high as some of the mountains that are around Amboy. I think a short ride in a Jeep would have told him more, but of course, he wasn't there to learn. It was just a show. I'm Lynn Wilcox. That's the Western View from Magnet West and Citrus Industry Magazine.
Celebrating the official spirit of America. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. June 14th is National Bourbon Day, so join friends and raise your glass of this sweetened amber spirit and celebrate great whiskey. Bourbon is a whiskey which is only so named if distilled in the United States. To legally be considered bourbon, it must be 51% corn, stored in new, not aged, charred oak barrels, and distilled no more than 160 proof and barreled at 125 proof. This particular whiskey derives its name from the Kentucky County, which was established in 1785 and was a large producer of corn. The corn, once distilled, would be put in barrels and stamped Old Bourbon and shipped down the Ohio River. In 1964, a congressional resolution designated bourbon as America's native spirit. Since then, there's nowhere else in the world that can make a whiskey and call it bourbon. So pour a glass of bourbon and use the hashtag National Bourbon Day to post on social media. I'm Kathy Eisen for AgNet West.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West, and welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook from an award-winning chef in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your host with the most. Let's get started. So today's recipe is a very special recipe. It's my once. I make this once a year, and I like to do the cooking on Father's Day just because I love cooking. My wife always insists on making food, but I'm like, you know what, honey? This is just once a year we do this recipe, and now I'm so honored to be able to share it with you. This is my recipe for my award-winning Untamed Chef rack of lamb. Let's get started. So the first thing we need to remember is this. What is a rack of lamb? Rack of lamb is actually lamb loin with the bone still attached to it. The fancy term rack of lamb actually looks like a rack, which is it's a rack of ribs, is realistically speaking, where you're they actually make these cuts. Now, when you're picking out a good lamb, I love personally to use something that's not as gamey. There are some people who love the flavor of gaminess. I'm not one of them. So what I like to do is I really appreciate any kind of California lamb that we can buy. It's going to be definitely less gamey than New Zealand lamb. But you have to do what you have to do, and I understand that completely. What I do first to get this whole process started is I'm going to preheat my oven to 425 degrees. Now, when I preheat my oven to 425 degrees, I'm going to turn my pan on already. I'm going to use a nice, I like using the saute pans that kind of look like woks. And the reason why is it's easier for me to transfer fat over without burning myself or making a mess. So I'm going to get that medium saute pan with a nice beveled edge on both sides. We want to make sure that not only does this pan get really, really hot, but we also want to make a quick transfer right into the oven. All I'm going to do is put my seasoned rack of lamb, just salt and pepper, into 3 tablespoons of olive oil. Once I build a beautiful crust in that, I'm going to add 3 tablespoons of sweet butter to this as well. And I'm going to go ahead and just start my basting process for doing this. Now, it's not going to take a long time to baste this, maybe about 2 minutes at the most. I take it out, put it into a nonstick pan, and go ahead and put it in the oven. And this is where it'll process the cooking. We'll finish in about 10 to 12 minutes. We just want medium rare whenever we're cooking a rack of lamb. I'm going to dump all the excess fat out of that pan, and I'm going to add to that a half a cup of red wine, a half a cup of aged balsamic, and 4 tablespoons of sugar. I'm gonna reduce that down by half, let it cool to room temperature, serve over the top of my lamb, and enjoy. For this and many more of my recipes, check me out at www.ajhtheuntamedchef.com to watch videos and other content that I produce. And as always, this is Albert J. Hernandez, and you can call me the Untamed Chef for AgNet West.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now. Earlier in the show, we heard Undersecretary of Agriculture for Trade and Foreign Agriculture Affairs, Ted McKinney's response to the first few days of their trade mission in Japan. Take a listen to what he had to say in his most recent press conference about speed dating trade sessions, diverse representation, and other trade topics.
Hello and good day. This is Stephanie Ho at USDA headquarters in Washington. It's no understatement to say Japan is one of the most important agricultural export markets for the United States. For items like beef and pork, it is America's top foreign customer. It's the number two market for U.S. corn and wheat, and third for consumer-oriented agricultural products. The Undersecretary is on the phone with us today from Tokyo. And so without further ado, I'll turn the microphone over to Undersecretary McKinney for opening comments.
Well, good morning. This is Ted McKinney, and just let me say, good morning here. I guess it's good evening there, and welcome to all of you from the news media who have an interest. I think most of you know that ag trade missions, ATMs as we call them, are one of our best tools to bring industries, commodity groups, livestock, poultry groups, growing small, medium businesses to foreign countries to introduce them in an organized way to potential buyers of their products. And of course, many times it results in buying and selling, which is ideal because trade, as I remind everyone, is a two-way street. We must never forget that. This one, of course, was chosen because Japan is one of our very major trading partners. So here's just some data about this one. We've been setting some records of late, and here I think we have another one. This is certainly the largest in numbers of attendees in the history of USDA and the Foreign Ag Service. Specifically, 42 U.S. agribusinesses, that's 4-2, and 15 state departments of agriculture. We can divide the ATMs up usually into different areas. For those businesses that are wanting to sell or buy, there are different receptions and things, but usually they have what I call the speed dating sessions. And we had a major one yesterday, and then today the entire group transports from Tokyo to Osaka, and they'll continue another 2 half-days of that. We can report there's already more than 375 business-to-business meetings. I have had a chance to visit briefly with many of those who are in the trade show, I guess, and they're very optimistic. Some have already made sales. Others who have not feel very positively about anywhere from 2 to 5 leads that they believe can be cultivated into something in the future. The representation across the team is quite diverse. Let me just go through a few. Wine, craft beers, spirits, juices, confection, cookies, cheesecake, honey, coffee, nut crops. For the Midwest folks, soy, corn, rice, beef, lamb, etc., fruit. And then we have some who aggregate purchases from the U.S. and deliver those, more of the processed goods. And then we can't forget ethanol has a smaller but important contingent, very focused. We have seafood, animal vet products, rice, and livestock genetics. So again, one of the more diverse in terms of businesses and occupations represented. That's the one segment, is the speed dating, the let's make a deal, the business to business. We also took the departments of ag and had good meetings with government. These are almost always a part of these. And so I led that, and we had a very productive meeting with the Ministry of Agriculture, Forestry, and Fisheries, and we met with the Minister of Ag. We also met with the Ministry of Health, Labor, and Welfare. They're very important because they're part of the regulatory system that approves a lot of product. And these were follow-up meetings with each of these two groups. I had met with them when I was here in March. And then the third part are various tours that enlighten us and I think others, our hosts. And that included a visit to an incredibly successful large supermarket retail chain. There we saw a great number of U.S. products on the shelves. animals. We also visited Glycopia Chiba, known as Glico. In this case, it's a dairy processing facility. And then for those who know the soy sauce business, we went to visit Kikkoman Noda. And that, too, was very, very successful. The rest of the trip involves the high-speed train to Osaka. And there we'll tour the Kobe port, one of Japan's largest. It handles all the containerized cargo. The Yamazika, Japan's most famous bread manufacturer. They purchase a lot of wheat and other products. The Kobe Meat Market Beef Auction, which is where Wagyu, that beef carcasses, are sold. And then Kirin Beer, which is Japan's largest beer brewing companies. They use a lot of our ingredients. And then some food sections of high-end department stores where they are purchasing products ready for sale. So I would say overall, it's been a very successful trip so far. Again, more than 375 business-to-business visits. And if we have that and more in Osaka, we may also have the all-time high number of business-to-business visits. And we'll then just have to see how those businesses calculate their anticipated sales over the next 12 months. And we'll come back to you on that. So I'm going to stop there. Just remind you, this is an ag trade mission. I've told you the three parts. And so we're happy to take your questions.
The first question goes to Tom Polansek from Reuters. Tom, please ask your question.
Hi, Undersecretary McKinney. Thanks for taking a little time to talk with us.
Yes.
Is it correct that Japan does not want to engage further with the U.S. on trade talks until there's an agreement on NAFTA?
That specific topic did not come up. I have heard that, but I can't validate that from the visits that that I had. As you know, there has been an ongoing economic dialogue, which is, I think, a step short of formal trade and negotiation talks. But that specific question did not come up.
Great. The next question comes from Rachel Lane with Farm World. Rachel, please ask your question.
Thank you very much for taking time to speak with us. You mentioned your earlier trip in March. A lot has changed since then. What concerns have the Japanese and the U.S. People involved expressed in this visit?
Well, I wouldn't say I noticed much. To remind folks why I was here in March, we were here for the very, very large FoodX food show, which is certainly the largest in Japan, and I would say the largest in this particular part of the world. And that was very enlightening, and we were here supporting a lot of our businesses, our commodity groups, livestock, poultry, etc. And I did meet with the government then, and I would say they wanted then for us to join TPP, and I expressed the administration's wishes that the preference is for a bilateral. But I would not say the tone, the demeanor has changed. In fact, I would walk away, as did my colleagues in the State Department of Ag, saying it was rather warm, and there was even some humor at times, which is the way I like it. But what we were talking about was advancements in each country's desire to bring different products either way. So it was not a setup at all to discuss whether we rejoin TPP or not, or whether we do a bilateral. That happened to come up. It was mostly us thanking them for some progress on some things. We updated on biotechnology and gene editing, which is of interest to them. And I shared with them where the U.S. is and has been, because some changes have been made, notably announcements from USDA. So it was more transactional in that regard than it was large negotiations, because those, as you know, are left primarily to USTR and the president. And so that's what we focused on.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now. Before the break, we were listening to a press conference with Secretary McKinney. Here are his responses to a few more questions.
The next questioner is Jackie Fatka from BeatsFest. Jackie, please ask your question.
Hello. Thanks for taking our calls today. Obviously, wheat is a big commodity that will be impacted a lot by TPP once it fully goes into effect with the other countries, with the United States not in it. Are there any products besides wheat that you've heard a lot of that we will be disadvantaged at a lot? And also, we've seen some tariff adjustments from Japan for beef. Are there some other adjustments that they could make on different products or additional beef access?
Well, let me pick up beef. We are hopeful for greater access as they resolve some of the restrictions on age of the beef And this is one of the things that we raised. I did not get a commitment, but I think they are moving through the process. I have found that the Japanese are good for their word. When they say they're progressing, just as when we say we are progressing, that doesn't mean it's a stall. It just means they're progressing. And so we're optimistic there. With respect to other industries, well, the tariffs could touch on a lot of them. I mean, livestock, poultry, several crops. But I want to remind people that while that risk is there, and it is, I will tell you I heard from the largest bread-making company in Japan who buys a lot of our wheat. They were at a reception last night. This is their CEO. We spoke to the CEO of the very large supermarket chain that we visited. And we visited others. You heard me say we were at Glico, and they buy some of our products. And they love quality of U.S. products. So while I'm sure, as a business person, they're going to look at all aspects, including price, I remind everybody, as I'm reminding you today, that the quality of U.S. products is superior. And people know that. And they're going to have to calculate whether a change in product is worth it, given that they have, you know, a good reputation for a good quality product at stake. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm satisfied that all will be well. I think we do need to get on with trade negotiations in one form or another, whichever way it goes. But I do remain optimistic that people love our products. And we heard that unsolicited yesterday on our tours, and certainly yesterday evening at a reception at the ambassador's residence.
The Forbes Ag Tech Summit will once again visit the Salad Bowl of California at the end of the month. The Salinas Valley will host the Forbes Ag Tech Summit June 26th through 28th in downtown Salinas. Forbes slogans the event is that it joins the smartest minds at the intersection of the Silicon Valley and global agriculture as they converge for the Forbes Ag Tech Summit to tackle critical challenges and showcase the latest innovations for farmers, investors, and stakeholders of the global food systems. This year, United States Deputy Secretary of Agriculture Steven Sinski will join Steve Forbes for the opening session. Bruce Taylor of Taylor Farms, Rob Trice of the Mixing Bowl, and Kip Tom of Tom Farms are among the many speakers at the two-day event. Aside from education and conversation, the invite-only event offers several opportunities for tech businesses to meet with both investment companies and the producers themselves. Forbes says one out of three summit participants are actual growers. Agnet West will again be at the event this year. Stay with Agnet West Radio and this radio station for all of the information. I'm Taylor Hillman for Agnet West Radio Network.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can follow Agnet West on Twitter and Facebook with @AgnetWest. Follow Brian German with @BrianAgnetWest, Danielle Leal with @DLealAgnetWest, and Taylor Hillman with @TheManOfTheHill. This has been Farm City Newsday by Agnet West.